As the students return, how are colleges and universities dealing with coronavirus? Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a closer look at how higher education here on the First Coast is working to keep students and faculty safe in this pandemic. Give us a call. Join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, as the RNC kicks off tonight, the political season kicks into high gear. Meanwhile, Indian Americans here on the First Coast are reflecting on the historic candidacy of Senator Kamala Harris. But first this hour, the latest on the COVID crisis. By the numbers, Florida surpassed 600,000 total positive tests for the pandemic Sunday. As statistics are pointing to a slowing trend in the spread of the virus, good news. However, the health department did report an increase of 51 deaths over the last 24 hours. And an additional 20 residents of long-term care facilities across Northeast Florida have had deaths reported from the coronavirus over the past week. Meanwhile, amidst these numbers, higher education is responding to the pandemic as college students head back to campus this month. Here in Jacksonville, Dean of Students Dr. Christy Gover is leading all efforts to respond to the pandemic on the JU campus. She's been instrumental in bringing students back to campus safely. We're kicking off the hour with a look at higher education in this pandemic as Dr. Christy Gover joins us on the line from JU. Dr. Gover, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me today.
Great to have you on the show. And here's our question to callers. Do you have a student going off to college? Do you teach at a college or university? Maybe you're a student yourself. Let us know how you're dealing with studying in the middle of a pandemic and enjoying campus life. The number to join us is 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. So, Dr. Gover, how is the first week of classes, or how was it, I should say? What's the mood on campus over at JU as the students come back?
The students are incredibly excited to be back on campus, although I'll also say that I don't know if they are as excited as we are to have them back after being gone for so many months.
Right.
The first week went very well. Everyone is adapting to the new normal and trying to stay flexible and focus on adaptability and how we can really keep our core goal at hand, which is the health and safety of our campus community.
And of course, that's the big challenge at campuses across the country. You know, we've seen every school from Notre Dame to the University of Georgia and closer to us make headlines over the last few weeks. For example, at Notre Dame, they had to suspend classes altogether because of off-campus parties that caused a COVID outbreak. At Georgia, there's been controversy over classes holding or not holding masked up sessions and so on. So you're in charge of all student life at JU, everything from soup to nuts, housing, dining, recreation, security, Greek life, student groups. How are you handling all of these COVID concerns with the student body? What are some of the protocols at JU to ensure that you don't see the kind of outbreak that we saw, for example, at Notre Dame?
We are engaging our students in being part of the solution. We've required face coverings in all indoor spaces and implemented many of the health and safety strategies that you'll see at almost any university. Last week, we held conversations with many of our campus leaders, our social influencers going into the first weekend of the semester, and asked them to play a role in keeping us a campus-based living and learning institution this fall. Those conversations went very well. Our athletic director met with the head and captains of each of our athletic teams. President Cost and I met with the leadership in our fraternity and sorority life. Our student government is engaged in this initiative, and it's critically important that the students understand and play an active role in keeping us on campus this semester.
Right. In the end, it's up to the students, isn't it? So How can you learn from other experiences that we've seen on other campuses? For example, at UNC Chapel Hill in North Carolina, students there are very angry because they've had to suspend in-person classes. And I know that's not what you want here in Jacksonville. So what type of message do you think is going to be successful with your student body so that you can keep campus life going, you can keep at least some in-person class going at JU?
The message is social responsibility. This is certainly a time where our size plays a significant benefit to us as a small private university. We have personal relationships with many of our students. And as I said before, we're calling on them to be part of the solution. They want to be back on campus. Over the course of the summer, on multiple occasions, they expressed a strong desire to be back here at JU. And we understand this is not the first year experience our freshmen envisioned. This is not the senior year our seniors envisioned, but this is their experience. And we're calling on them to make the most of it in a safe and healthy way.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with JU's Dean of Students, Dr. Christy Gover, about college and COVID. Students are headed back to campus this month at JU, UNF, FSCJ, Edward Waters College, all in our area, and some other institutions of higher learning around the region. We want to hear from you, whether you've sent a student off to school, whether you teach on a college campus maybe, or you're a student yourself, or just if you have any questions about college and COVID. It's 549-2937. Now, Dr. Gover, JU has been quite transparent about your positive COVID cases on campus. You released a COVID tracker for JU. So that is to be commended. How is the university managing active cases on campus, and how does it compare with what other schools are doing?
We are being transparent with the number of cases. We believe it's important for our campus community to know what the situation looks like firsthand. We're very fortunate that throughout the course of the summer, as we made modifications to de-densify our housing, we secured spaces for quarantine and isolation. We've also partnered with off-campus organizations to secure campus off-campus housing for students as well, if that becomes a necessity. And so between the two, we have over 100 spaces that we can use for quarantine and isolation if we're in a position where we need to activate those spaces. We're working with our dining services provider to do 3 meals a day deliveries to our students who are in quarantine and isolation, and connecting them with mental health counseling. That is an important piece of the equation here, as being in a room by yourself for 2 weeks in quarantine can take a mental toll on you. We're also first and foremost encouraging our students, if they're able to travel home, if they have a family member who can pick them up, that it's really best if they can quarantine in their own home so they have the support of their family in a time like this as well. And we're working with a number of different areas to make sure that we're in a great space to test and trace and treat and everything in between in this new reality.
Right. And of course, so much of campus life deals with the social aspect. And that's something obviously that has been sharply curtailed. On the JU campus, you're advising no gatherings of 10 or more people. That means no parties. No student clubs for the most part, limited sports and fitness classes. What has the reaction been like among the students to, you know, not having those experiences that are such a big part of college life?
We are relying on our students to focus on developing those one-on-one relationships. The learning that takes place outside the classroom is critically important, and some of that comes through conversations that you have with your roommate late at night, or the resident advisor who is checking on you each day to make sure that you're doing well. So focusing on building those personal relationships, gatherings of 10 or fewer students, as you mentioned, many of our organizations are having virtual meetings, or if they can safely do an in-person meeting, we're taking advantage of our outdoor space. We have a number of outdoor spaces right here on the waterfront where students can gather in a safe space. Our intramural programs are looking at low contact options for students to engage in that physical activity, and really just focus on providing opportunities for students to build relationships, but to do so in a safe way. It is certainly a challenge to make sure that we're providing those opportunities for students to gather socially, but we're focusing on that engagement piece more so than the social gathering piece.
Sure, because of course, the big existential question for higher education right now, Dr. Gover, is how do you convince parents to continue paying for the higher educational experience if it's mostly online? Now, that's not the case at JU. You have welcomed students back to campus for the most part. But that's a big thorny problem that higher education is having to deal with. Do you think over the long term, higher education might have to change its whole model as a result of what we're enduring now in this pandemic? How do you see this playing out on college campuses over time?
I believe we will start to see more mentorship programs where we're focused on those one-on-one relationships. We'll also start to see the engagement in the classroom environment, whether it's online or face-to-face, be a more critical piece of the equation as it pertains to keeping students connected and engaged with one another and building those relationships with each other in the classroom and building those relationships with their faculty members instead of relying more heavily on our social organizations to build those relationships. Our resident advisors play an important role in making sure that our students are doing well and finding the connections they need. But we are creating a new normal. We are redefining the culture on college campuses. And we are going to look to our students to tell us what works for them and what they want to see in their college experience.
The new normal on college campuses is what we're talking about this morning with Dean of Students Christy Gover at JU. We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. Here is an email from a listener. Does everyone at JU have to wear a mask? They ask. And of course they do, right, Dr. Gover? Let's explain exactly how this is being handled. You are requiring everyone to be masked up, but you also are doing as much in-person instruction as you can, correct?
That's correct. And we consulted with the experts at Mayo Clinic, Florida Department of Health. We're adhering to the guidelines for the CDC and the World Health Organization. So in consultation, as we were developing our plan, we determined that it was safe to hold in-class meetings as long as students and faculty were wearing face coverings and maintaining 6 feet of social distance. And so we have designed our in-person class meetings to meet those guidelines. And that will allow us to continue to maintain in-person classes. And we also require face coverings in all indoor spaces, with the exception of when a student is inside their residence hall room with their roommate.
Let me ask you about this. There have been reports at campuses around the country that the partisan divide over masks has blanketed every aspect of American life, and that includes the college campus, because certainly college students follow along a political spectrum like everybody else does. Have you seen any debates or divisions among the student body at JU based on political affiliation over the mask mandate, and any discussions about that?
We have not yet seen that divide play out on our campus. I believe the majority of our students and our community are interested in maintaining the health and safety of the campus. And I've been very pleased to see that the majority of our students are adhering to that mask requirement. And frankly, there are consequences if they don't adhere to our policies and guidelines.
What are the consequences?
It depends on the situation, of course, but if a student shows up to a class and they're not wearing a face covering, they'll be asked to either go to a nearby office and grab a face covering, or they can tune in online for the class that day.
What has been the toughest thing about this for higher education administrators like yourself? We've all been challenged, obviously, in these times, but in terms of college life, university life, what's been the toughest thing for you?
For me, the most difficult thing has been finding that balance of providing opportunities for students to connect socially and engage and build those relationships that are so critically important to their success in college and beyond, and making sure that 18 to 24-year-olds are adhering to the safety guidelines that we've put in place. And I believe that will be an ongoing challenge throughout the semester for all colleges and universities as we really work to create a campus experience for students and do so with the health and safety of the campus as our core value.
Here is an email for you, Dr. Gover, from Mary in Ortega. She says, because COVID is a deadly virus, is JU implementing disciplinary action for students who go to parties or practice inappropriate behavior? What about that? Because certainly these parties we've seen at other campuses has led to school shutting down or in-person instruction completely shutting down.
Right. Our code of conduct is founded on respect, and we're asking each of our students to honor the respect that accompanies wearing a face covering and behaving in a way that is supportive of keeping our campus in person this semester. So we will be meeting with students through our conduct process who violate the university policies as it relates to COVID or otherwise, and we will be treating those on an individual basis depending on the situation. But absolutely, we expect our students to adhere to our policies, and there is an accountability piece that accompanies that.
COVID on campus, as we go to your calls right now, it's 549-2937. Give us a call. Rusty on the west side. Hi, Rusty. Good morning.
Hello, Melissa. You touched on, you used the phrase existential crisis for higher ed. And just something I've noticed creeping into the marketing of the University of North Florida in particular is they now say they use, in the context of skyrocketing cost of higher ed, they've started to use the phrase fields, I don't know, which are in demand, something like that. So is it still the philosophy of a liberal arts institution that if a kid wants to major in Scott's literature or the evolution of sea snails, that they're
right,
kind of on their own as far as employability?
Oh, boy. That, you've touched a can of worms, Rusty, but I'm glad you did. Now, Dr. Gover, obviously your immediate concern is just keeping the kids alive and keeping them on pace to get through the school year. But what about Rusty's comment? Because I think that this is a conversation educators are having all over the country right now. And we did touch on it a few moments ago. But you said we need to think about a new normal for higher ed. Let's talk a little bit more about what that might look like, how that might affect the majors students choose, whether they choose on-campus or online learning, how costs will be recalibrated, all of those things. What are your thoughts as you contemplate this?
I believe there is still a place, a strong place, for the liberal arts education. And at the core of every skill set we want our students to have, we want our students to be able to communicate effectively, to interact with others, to be able to be successful in a diverse environment. And you are able to really accomplish that learning in the liberal arts education. I understand that there are a number of our students, a growing student population, who are interested in our majors like nursing, which is one of our most popular and most rigorous majors in the sciences. And we have a state-of-the-art career management office that helps all of our students identify what their career possibilities might be regardless of their major. We have also adapted our curriculum so that students can pair their majors together to make sure that they have accomplished acquiring all of the skills necessary to be successful beyond the comforting walls of the educational environment. And I would be remiss if I didn't say, as the Dean of Students, that I believe a lot of the learning that takes place outside the classroom is the application of the learning that takes place inside the classroom, whether it's on the athletic field or in a leadership position that you may hold within your student organization or fraternity and sorority. You're utilizing and practicing those skills. And so I think that we have to continue to focus on that learning that occurs both in the classroom, outside the classroom, the connection between the two, and then certainly the connection with what their career may look like beyond higher education.
Yeah, because, you know, as we're having this conversation, Dr. Gover, I'm reminded of a recent sort of dust up between college professors and parents of the students paying for that college. It went viral. The parents were complaining about the high cost of tuition if their kids' campus experience was all going to be virtual. And they said, you know, we're your customers. We're not getting what we're paying for. And the professor retorted back, you are not our customers. You know, this isn't a customer vendor relationship. And so that really brings up the deeper question, about when you're paying for a top tier private educational experience like what you get at JU, you're paying for all those intangibles. And as Dean of Students, you are in charge of all those ancillary things that go up to make a great college experience. The socializing, the student groups, the Greek life, everything that the kids participate in, staying up late and talking with friends in the dorms, going to parties, which hopefully at some point they can do again. I think we're all collectively mourning the loss of all of these experiences in our lives, and certainly that transcends to the college campus. And so what do you say to parents who are voicing these kinds of angry comments at the college tuition offices around America today, you know, saying we're not getting what we're paying for, because college isn't a typical vendor customer relationship. It's something else. So what do you say to those who voice those comments?
I say take advantage of the resources that are available to your student. And while they may not physically be in person, they also have the opportunity to develop that relationship with their faculty member. They also have the opportunity to engage in a variety of different ways virtually, whether it's taking advantage of virtual mental health counseling or virtual tutoring, consultations with our staff in Career Resource Center or the Career Management Office. And oftentimes the relationships they build with our faculty members are some of the most critical relationships they develop at the university that help them acquire their first job or mentor them through their first job. And so I believe that while classes may be online, whether it's at Jacksonville University or otherwise, there is an opportunity for students to take advantage of all the resources that are available at a university.
Jim emails the show, what's going on with athletics? Are the teams at JU going to get to play sports? He wants to know.
The question of the day.
Yeah, right.
Our student athletes will continue to stay engaged with their teams and practice and training and otherwise. We will lean on the guidance from our conference to determine when we can get back on the field or get back on the court. But we are preparing for exactly that, and our student athletes are excited to be back. They're committed to keeping us open and in person. And that's for a number of reasons. Our student athletes are some of our very best students academically, and they are also really committed to getting back into play. And as of right now, the majority of our sports will begin their actual competition in the spring semester.
Let me ask you as well about the plan as the school year progresses. As I reported at the top of the hour, cases are starting to decline in Florida, which is good news. That said, the virus could heat up again through the school year. Colder weather, flu season, that's something I know you're planning for, as is every administrator in charge of this kind of portfolio. What's the plan for the fall and winter, particularly if we start to see outbreaks and spikes again in caseload, Dr. Gover?
Thank you. Yes, we are first and foremost asking each of our students to get a flu shot, and we're making those available at our Student Health Center. We also modified the dates of our academic term. The students will have the same number of classroom days they had, classroom instruction they had last fall, but it will be the semester will end prior to the Thanksgiving break. And that is really to allow students to complete their complete their semester. If they choose to go home, they can go home. The residence halls will remain open for anyone who chooses to stay on campus during that time. That provides us with the opportunity to offer an online winter term for any student who wants to engage in online learning during that winter term. And then our semester, spring semester, will start later. And that is to reduce the amount of time that there is an overlap between COVID and flu season and being in in-person learning. And so we're hopeful that that mitigation strategy is going to pay off, but we will certainly continue to monitor our percentage of cases on campus with the Duval County percentage and state of Florida.
Right. I mean, if there's one thing we've all learned in this crisis, it's the importance of being nimble and changing plans if need be. And I'm sure at JU, you've been through quite a bit of that, right? As we all have.
Right. Flexibility, adaptability, and the willingness to pivot when we need to pivot as we're all continuing to learn about the virus and how it impacts our campus community and the members of our community.
Which category of students do you think has had the toughest break, Dr. Gover, the incoming freshmen or the graduating seniors?
Great question. I think I'm going to side with the freshmen on this. They had a significant impact to their senior year in high school, and coming out of that impact, they're entering their college experience, and we're asking them to modify their behavior and really change their expectations of what their freshman year of college looked like. But the message we're sending to students is, it may not be exactly as you envisioned 4 years ago when you started thinking about your university, but this is your experience, and we want you to make the most of it.
And what about the faculty at JU? What are you messaging to them right now? Because they are also coming back and interacting with students and masking up to teach class.
Right. We have an incredible group of faculty led by our provost, Dr. Chris Sapienza, and our head of faculty, Dr. Mary Gibson. And I really commend our academic leadership for staying connected throughout the summer, engaging faculty and developing our plan to return to the campus. And we're asking them to stay in touch and let us know what they're experiencing in the classroom and how we can best support their efforts in the classroom as well.
And what's your final advice to parents out there if they've got a child in college or they're planning to send their child to college this year or next in the middle of these extraordinary times? And I put our household in that category. It's something we're planning and worrying about and trying to figure out how to handle.
Right. My advice is to encourage your student to be adaptable and flexible and have a conversation about expectations. Your student, whether they're living on campus or living in your home, will continue to look to you for guidance. And so to have a conversation about those expectations. Our students indicated a strong desire to return to campus, and we have a responsibility to deliver that in a safe and healthy way.
Terry tweets the show, great conversation. I had heard there was a trend in learners preferring online experience. That said, of course, as we've learned from Dr. Gover, they are providing as much in-person learning on the JU campus as they can, as students did come back to campus this month at JU in Arlington and at other campuses around the First Coast and Florida. And so, Dr. Gover, it's really good to get your insights about the higher education situation in this pandemic. I hope the next time we talk, we'll be in a different place. So thank you so much for getting on the line with us this morning. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Melissa. I appreciate the opportunity.
Much more still ahead later in the hour. The First Coast Heart Walk is going virtual this year. Now, that's the biggest walk of its kind in Northeast Florida, but you can be part of the big experience. We'll tell you how. All it takes is your smartphone. That's later in the hour. But up next.
And I look at this as a proud moment for every American because it constitutes progress.
The RNC kicks off tonight after last week's DNC as the presidential campaigns kick into high gear. Indian Americans on the First Coast, meanwhile, are sharing their thoughts on the historic candidacy of Senator Kamala Harris, what it means for their community and also African Americans. Much more is still to come. Keep listening. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back.
Turntable Tuesday can now be heard on Anthology on the WJCT app and 89.9 HD3. For the best on vinyl, listen to Anthology Tuesdays at 9. Turntable Tuesday, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
Dig, research, question, repeat. That's what we do every week on Reveal.
I have here thousands of pages of documentation of murder.
I'm Al Ledson, host of Reveal, the weekly radio show from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. Reveal, because there's always more to the story.
Saturday afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Electro Lounge can now be heard 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on WJCT 89.9 HD4 Electro Lounge Radio or on the WJCT app. Electro Lounge Radio, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
Well, after last week's Democratic National Convention wrapped up, a virtual affair that was widely praised for its technical proficiency and speakers, the RNC will begin tonight with 4 nights of programming. There will be some more in-person events than what we saw from the DNC, according to President Trump and the campaign. Now, as the presidential campaign kicks into high gear, both Black Americans and Indian Americans continue to reflect on the historic candidacy of Senator Kamala Harris. Harris is the first woman of color chosen to run on a presidential ticket. And it's bringing up an exciting and complex well of emotions for voters of color across America who come from different communities. Parvez Ahmed, PhD, directs diversity and inclusion on the UNF campus, and I spoke with him about Harris's historic run. Parvez Ahmed, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Melissa.
You know, the nomination of Kamala Harris for the Democratic Party's vice presidency is historic. Black Americans are reacting, and so are South Asian and Indian Americans to this historic breakthrough. As an Indian American, I know that you have a lot to say about this. What are your feelings and thoughts right now?
Well, it is indeed a proud moment, and I look at this as a proud moment for every American because it constitutes progress, that our country is moving towards that ideal where people are indeed judged by the content of their character and their abilities and not by their skin color. It also represents a important step forward for the South Asian community, the Indian community. Generally speaking, the Indian community is quite a successful minority in this country, often held out as a model minority, which I think is a disservice to the community because if the community is diverse, on average, South Asians and Indians generally do well. But there are lots of people in the South Asian community that struggle with all kinds of issues, from mental health issues to economic issues to every other issue that afflicts all other Americans. So I think it's an important step forward, and it's a historic moment that I think all of us can cherish.
Right, and it's interesting to get your perspective on this. Even a positive stereotype is still a stereotype because every community is diverse. Yeah, and so
absolutely.
So we saw Kamala Harris give a shout out to her aunties using a Tamil expression, and
right.
That really launched a lot of excitement on social media because communities that haven't been represented before get excited when they see that kind of powerful representation from someone who's now in such a prominent position, right?
Absolutely. You know, Kamala Harris's background and her story is very interesting, and it's a story that is perhaps only possible in America. Her mom comes from India, marries someone who is an immigrant from Jamaica, raised two children on her own. The mom and dad got separated. Although her mom is of Indian descent and culturally rooted in her Indian roots, she makes a choice to raise her daughter as a Black American. That's a choice that her parents made. Her mom made. And that in and of itself is a story that is probably not only only possible in America, but it's a story that is perhaps needs to be told in ways that we have not considered what the full scope of that story is.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about the reasoning behind that, why her mother made that decision. What was it about American culture that felt that she felt that was the right decision for her child?
I do not know. I mean, of course, we would not, we will perhaps never know the answer to that question. Her mom passed away. But in some sense, one could say that her mom was living at the intersection of two immigrant experiences and understood that intersectionality almost decades before we even knew about the term intersectionality. She understood that despite her Indian heritage, Kamala Harris and her sister would be considered black in this country. And since they would be considered black in the eyes of everybody else, she was eager to kind of impart in their children a black experience that is authentic. So she went and attended an HBCU. She worshipped at a black Baptist church. It was a conscious decision by her family, and that kind of shaped who she is. And yet Kamala Harris has deep roots to the Indian community. She writes in her book that she would often visit India with her mom. She is close to her aunts and an extended family in India. So all of that has created this moment in both the immigrant Caribbean community, in the immigrant Indian community, in the black American community, that each of this community can claim Kamala Harris as their own.
Right. Several different spheres now excited about her candidacy. And let me ask
you... It's an excitement, but there is also kind of a concern also.
What's that?
So undoubtedly, the historic nature of the candidacy cannot be underestimated. The concerns are at two levels. At one level, it's a backlash that she would inevitably be drawing towards her. Racist trope, misogynist tropes that would be directed towards her. We saw this play out in 2016 with Hillary Clinton. That will just be weaponized again in much more potent form than we saw in 2016. So at one level, you have that concern. The other level of concern is Kamala Harris's own record in terms of dealing with issues that are important to these communities. For example, in the Indian community is diverse over here. There are people in the Indian community that are supporters of the nationalist Hindu leader that is ruling India right now. That's the Prime Minister of India right now. And there are lots of Indians who are troubled by the nationalist bent, the nationalist trajectory that India is moving in.
And just so I can make clear to what you're saying, the Prime Minister there, Modi, he's promoting Hinduism over the other religious and ethnic groups that live in India, which is a really diverse, complicated country. But Hindu groups are being elevated, aren't they, over Muslims and other types of Indians, other citizens?
It is. Yeah, it is also a reflection of what President Barack Obama spoke about last night, which is it, just like the American democracy finds itself in a crossroad, that there is a possibility that our democracy may not survive if we have another 4 years of Trump. That same concern is much more potent in India. Indians are deeply concerned that its secular democratic character of this country may not survive if Modi remains unchecked in power for too long. But there are lots of people who are strong supporters of Narendra Modi, and there are lots of people who are against Narendra Modi. And Kamala Harris's own take on where India is right now is kind of mixed. On one hand, she even recently applauded India as a secular democratic republic, but she failed to note that just like democracy and secularism are under assault in this country, the same thing is happening in India. So some Indians are concerned that Kamala Harris, who has a strong rhetoric against authoritarian leaders like Putin and China's Xi and Maduro in Venezuela has not been as critical of Modi as perhaps many would like her to be.
That's some interesting context. And so as the presidential campaign goes forward, this is a ticket that's been unlike any other to date in this country. How do you see other Americans, those that are not part of the groups you mentioned, reacting to Kamala Harris?
I think the reaction for most Americans would be very positive. I think it would be a similar kind of reaction that people had when, in 2008, when a man named Barack Hussein Obama was on the ticket. The fact that Obama won with strong majorities, not only in 2008 but also in 2012, shows that most Americans reflected on his agenda, his governing agenda, his policy position, were impressed with his bio, and they rewarded him accordingly. I think that same possibility exists for Kamala Harris. How she will capture this moment where the spotlight would undeniably be on her because of the historic nature of her candidacy will to a large extent depend on how she reacts to this moment. Just as when Obama was coming up, yes, the country was eager for hope and change as reflected in the election results, but Obama had to perform. He had to inspire people. He had to give them programmatic policy agendas that people could rally behind. So Kamala Harris and Joe Biden will have the same opportunity, and I hope they rise to that moment.
Parvez Ahmed, always good to get your insights. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
A quick break, and still ahead, it's the largest walk of its kind in Northeast Florida, but this year the First Coast Heart Walk is going virtual. Yeah, no surprise. Here's the thing, though. There are ways you can participate, and there's still time. We're going to take a closer look in just a moment. Don't go away. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Keep listening. We'll be right back.
This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Max Mayfield, former director of the National Hurricane Center. This hurricane season, you need to update your family preparedness plan so it includes COVID-19 preparations. So when a storm threatens, be ready to prepare your home and have your family hurricane kit ready. Include supplies for your pets and enough COVID-19 sanitizers, disinfectant wipes, and masks. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorm.org.
The Republican Party preparing for its nominating convention today looks radically different than it did in 2016.
I would say this is Donald Trump's party, and I don't think that should be much of a surprise. I mean, political parties have always evolved.
I'm Audie Cornish. How a party of free trade and strong global alliances became one of America First populism this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
starting at 4 here on WJCT News 89.9.
The Republican National Convention begins tonight. It's a chance for President Trump to tout the achievements of his first term.
After years of building up other nations, we're finally building up our nation.
Tune in tonight for live coverage of the first day of the Republican National Convention with recaps and analysis tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Tonight at 9 here on WJCT News 89.9.
It's the Republican Party's turn to make its case. Big themes at the RNC include a land for heroes and opportunity, a land of promise and greatness. But some conservatives say they feel distant to a party enthralled to President Trump. What land are they in? I'm Jen White. The week ahead for the right, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, it's the largest walk of its kind here in Northeast Florida. But this year, the First Coast Heart Walk is going virtual. Still, there are plenty of ways you can participate. I learned more from Scott Wooten, Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer at Baptist Health and the 2020 First Coast American Heart Association Board Chair. Hey, Scott. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Melissa. Good to be with you.
And of course, like so many other events that are trying to make their way through this time of pandemic, the First Coast Heart Walk is continuing your tradition, but doing it digitally. Now, this is the largest walk in Jacksonville, and it's a big deal. So how will things look this year? What can we expect?
This year's Heart Walk is going to be a lot of fun, and it's going digital. And our theme is Walk Where You Are. It's going to begin on September 11th at noon for a 20-minute kickoff. And then the fun's going to kick in again on Saturday, September 12th at 9 a.m. as we challenge everyone to walk where they are. And the cool thing is they really can do whatever they want. They can walk or run or cycle or play. And we really want people to just kind of join in on social media at hashtag First Coast Heart Walk.
Right. They can post their own experiences wherever they like. And, you know, in the past, of course, everybody has gotten out and walked together. They can now do this separately, but still together. I know it's important for you to talk about how this really is more than a one-day event. It's really a community-wide effort to get companies and people working and talking about the importance of fighting heart disease and stroke. That's the big message, even more so right now, right? Because of the pandemic and how that is a threat to our health.
Absolutely. This really is a national effort to help fight heart and stroke disease, which is the number one killer in the United States and the number one cause of disability. And the event really is about celebrating life and honoring those who have survived and those whom we've lost. So we're going to get out and lace it up and have some fun and stay fit together. It also is critical, as you know, to helping to fund the life-saving research and training, which is the mission of the American Heart Association.
Right. And I know this isn't a big message from the event, but also with the virus, we don't know the long-term effects of how it can damage our cardiovascular system. That's a concern I think so many of us have, given that heart disease was the number one killer in this community to begin with. And now with COVID, we have that additional worry. But the whole point of the Heart Walk is to send that message that most heart diseases, cardiovascular diseases, are preventable. There's so much we can do with our choices to be healthier. We just have to keep getting that message out, right?
That's exactly right, Melissa. And, you know, the diseases claim over 800,000 Americans each year, heart and stroke disease. And the good news that is over nearly 80% of that is preventable, as you said. So the Heart Walk really is about educating everyone about how to manage the risk factors and the simple ways to get our health under control. Things like managing our blood pressure, not smoking, eating better, and taking care of ourselves by moving more. We want everyone to get involved in the Heart Walk and be good role models in good heart and brain health.
Yeah, and people can do this through their companies or they can just do it individually. I know a lot of companies have teams that are planning their neighborhood walks, correct?
That's exactly right. Companies and team members of those companies, and then we have community teams also. People who are celebrating the survivors and their families or loved ones, or honoring those whom the disease has taken. And those community teams are forming right now. And that really, Melissa, is where we need your help and the audience's help today. We would love each person to bring our mission to life, to help be healthy, stay healthy, and help us fund the research necessary to fight the number one cause of death in the United States, heart and stroke disease.
Yeah. So it's easy to get started. You just want people to register to be part of the Heart Walk. It's firstcoastheartwalk.org. And so once people go into that website, Scott, they can take it from there, right?
They absolutely can take it from there. And we're looking forward to having everyone lace it up on September 12th, Melissa.
Right. The walk itself is September 12th, but register now at firstcoastheartwalk.org. And when you go out and walk on the day, you need to, you know, document it, as Scott said, with the hashtag for the First Coast Heart Walk. And remind me what that is again. I want to make sure I get that out there, too.
You got it. It's hashtag First Coast Heart Walk.
Just hashtag First Coast Heart Walk. Make sure to register and walk for your health, walk to save lives. This is the biggest walk of its kind in Jacksonville, and this year it's going to be a digital experience. So thank you, Scott. He's Scott Wooten, Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer at Baptist Health and the 2020 First Coast American Heart Association Board Chair. Have a great walk, Scott. Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks so much, Melissa. Have a great day.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening, and to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield edits our digital operations. Keep those emails coming, meanwhile, to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We value your feedback. You can catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 or our podcast wherever you get yours. We'll be up online later today. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow and connect with you then. Have a great week and stay masked up.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.